2001 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium, session number 164, Lost in the Translation, Mormon Culture and the Myth of the Perfect Language. Participants, Hugo N. Olaiz and David C. Knowlton.
In Hispanic linguistics, Hugo is an accredited interpreter, translation being written, interpretation being spoken. He's currently starting up a translation company called Lucero Translations and lives in Salt Lake City. I don't have a bio for David Knowlton, but I'm not really sure I need much of a bio for David. David is, of course, an anthropologist by training, sort of the recognized specialist in issues, LDS issues related to Latin America, taught briefly at BYU and then left amid great public furor, is now teaching, I believe, anthropology at the University of Utah. His comments being read by a student of his, Scott Lewis. Scott is finishing up a double degree in history and Spanish. He does freelance journalistic work and will start working at the City Weekly this fall. So with no further ado, let's move it over to Hugo, and then we'll move straight on to Scott's reading of David's comments.
Thank you, John Charles. One thing about David that I would like to say is that well, he's sorry he's not can be here. He cannot be here. He's in Cusco, Peru. He sent me an email 2 days ago. It's amazing now how through the internet we can communicate. And he's teaching a class, I think, on anthropology in Cusco, but he's going to be back very soon for when classes start at the University of Utah. In 1996, Teresa Watanabe of Los Angeles Times asked President Hinckley the following question. Question: has internationalization led your homegrown American church to make any changes to accommodate the diverse foreign cultures? Answer: I don't think so. I think we've had the same program followed, the same doctrine taught in a congregation in Johannesburg as you would in Salt Lake City. On a given Sunday, you'll even find the same Sunday school lesson being taught across the world. There are several interpretations about this question and answer. One of them is that this is classic President Hinckley engaged in the classic act of dodging a journalistic question. The question was about culture. His response was about programs and doctrine. The truth that President Hinckley so brilliantly evaded is that today the church finds itself in a contradictory position. On the one hand, we claim to be tolerant and accepting of all cultures because, after all, the gospel is for the whole world. On the other, we impose our standards of dress, discourse, and organization wherever we go. In this essay, I will talk about language, culture, and translation. I think we all intuitively see that language and culture are analogous phenomena. We all have a native language and a native culture, which we modify as we move from one situation to another. Our linguistic behavior, as well as our cultural behavior, are conventions that we use to interact with other people. Language and culture send strong messages about our identity and our value system, who we are, who we want to be, how we perceive other people to be. This is all deeply encoded in our verbal and nonverbal behavior. I recently read an essay by Michael Hicks on Mormonism and music. He relates the story of President Kimball, who in 1965 was invited to BYU to address the Lamanite students, which at BYU include the Native Americans, most of Latin Americans, and the Polynesians. Now, many of you know that President Kimball was an advocate for the Lamanites, as no other prophet, particularly for the Native Americans. This is what President Kimball had to say on that occasion. Then in New Zealand, I was a recipient of many, many courtesies while I was there. They sang and they danced. They sang their songs and they rolled their eyes and they stuck out their tongues. And so we applauded, you know, and they think that's wonderful to encourage the continuation of their culture. That isn't the Lord's culture. What they are doing is perpetuating the paganism that they brought from other islands. President Kimball urged the islanders to stop digging up the cultures of yesterday that were paganistic. Anything that is associated with paganism or sectarianism or devilism or anything, we eliminate. Have we made any progress since? We celebrate Samoa, lavalavas, and Mexican sombreros, But do we do them because they are alternatives to, valid alternatives to our way of dressing, or just because they are exotic and cute? How does the church, how do the church leaders feel today about Africans playing the drums? How about polygamous cultures in so many parts of the world? How about cultures that practice tattooing or body piercing? More importantly, is it possible that the LDS leaders have adopted a model of corporate culture that permeates every aspect of the Mormon Church? Even though my academic training is in linguistics and in translation, what I will share today is more related to my personal experiences than to my professional training. You see, just like many of you, I was born in the LDS Church. I spent my childhood and adolescence going to church, singing Mormon hymns, and having family home evenings. However, unlike most of you, this experience was carried out entirely in Spanish and in an Argentine setting. As a child, I believed that God, the prophet, and the 12 apostles spoke only Spanish. But at the age of 10, I realized that this was not the case. Spanish was only a secondary language to the church, as well as all the other languages, with only one exception. English is the primary language. When Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon, he translated it into English. When Brigham Young said, "This is the right place," he said it into in English. When President Kimball admonished every young man to go on a mission, he admonished them in English. More importantly, when I was a teenager, I discovered that most of the church's publications had not been translated into Spanish, and that those that had been translated, including the standard works, contained mistakes and mistranslations. In South America, this linguistic reality instantly creates two types of Mormons. On the one hand, a privileged minority who can afford English schools and delve into the mysteries in the original tongue. On the other hand, the masses, who speak only Spanish and must content themselves with a translation. Now I will say a few words about translation. It seems to me that from the days of Joseph Smith, Mormons have inherited at least two opposing views about translation. The first proposes that translating can be a perfect one-to-one operation. This view is reinforced by early Mormon belief in Adamic, a language where there is a perfect match between word and meaning. According to the Book of Ray Price, the children of Adam were taught to read and to write in a language that was pure and undefiled. The Book of Mormon suggests that during the Confession of Babel, this pure and perfect language was preserved by the Jaredites. And on one occasion that Brigham Young spoke in tongues, Joseph Smith identified the language as pure Adamic. The belief in Adamic is one of the versions of a more general myth that appears in many cultures around the world. It's a myth of the perfect language. Those who are interested in this myth and in modern attempts to create a perfect language, there's a book by Umberto Eco called In Search of the Perfect Language. The myth usually refers to a primeval past, a golden age when people, animals, and the whole earth lived in undisturbed harmony. Communication was then perfect because it was achieved through a perfect medium. Now, in the Mormon version of this myth, the perfect language is not only in our distant past, but also in our near future. It's part of the restoration of all things. According to John W. Taylor, who was an apostle at the turn of the century, the day will come when it will not be necessary for anyone to speak in an unknown tongue, for the original Adamic language will be restored, and all shall speak in one tongue. The first view about translation is that it can be a perfect one-to-one operation. The second view about translation is a lot trickier, but closer to linguistic theory. Words never come alone. They come in textual, geographical, cultural, and historical contexts. Words come loaded with history, denotation, connotations, and meanings that change dynamically over time. Accordingly, translating is always an exercise in approximation. The French, who are not very politically correct, say that translations are like women. Those that are faithful are seldom beautiful, and those that are beautiful are seldom faithful. The truth is even more complex than that. A translation can take numerous forms depending on its purpose. It can focus on the literal meaning of individual words. It can focus on the whole message of the text. It can include glosses,
footnotes, explanations, and even scholarly commentaries and interpretations. You can also attempt to preserve some of the formal characteristics of the original text, such as rhyme or alliteration. You can subscribe to a particular literary tradition and imitate some of its formal traits, such as Joseph Smith using the King James Bible language in his translation of the Book of Mormon. Finally, you can choose to show very little respect for the original text, change the register, adapt a number of cultural elements. Translation always reflects the preferences, the biases, and the limitations of the translators. Now, I'm going to talk about the myth of the perfect translation as revised by in the 70s in BYU. The notion that translating can be a simple one-to-one operation was revived in the 1970s when the LDS Church created the Translation Sciences Institute at Brigham Young University. The institute was the result of two important Mormon ideas. First, the notion that God gave us technology so that we can spread the gospel to all nations. Second, the idea that perfect truths should be expressed with a perfect language. It was a time of great expectations, but also a time of phenomenal failures. Many people were convinced that the project would be a resounding success. Some church leaders said that the day was close when the voice of warning would be unto all people simultaneously. The day when Dallin H. Oaks was installed as president of BYU, Harold B. Lee gave to the academic community the challenge to contribute in the creation of, quote, some electronic device by which we could speak in English and our hearers would understand, each in his own language, unquote. Similarly, articles in the Ensign suggested that the new computers could probably someday translate General Conference in real time, and the product was going to be a perfect translation. Some church leaders said from the pulpit that President Kimball would soon speak through a microphone and an electronic synthesizer would reproduce his words in real time in 20 or 30 languages with the same tone, timbre, and modulation of the original voice. Well, today we know enough about language and computers to be more cautious. The ultimate failure of the Translation Sciences Institute underscores extraordinary complexities of the translation process. Today, General Conference speeches are processed in the same basic fashion as in the 1970s. The speeches are given to translators a few days in advance. The translators write interlinear translations. During General Conference, they read their translations as they listen to the speaker, keeping the same pace. They improvise interpretations only on the rare occasions when the speaker improvises or deviates from the written text. Now let me go back to culture. Every time the LDS Church sends missionaries overseas, every time we build a chapel, every time a general authority visits a foreign country, we become not only the promoters of Mormon religion, but also the exporters of a particular brand of culture. Unfortunately, some discoverers are willing to imitate what they see to the point of the ridiculous. When I was at the MTC, I was told the story about a convert who would kneel down in prayer with the missionaries at the end of every discussion. Just like the elders, at the end of the prayer, he would dust his knees. He acquired the habit of dusting his knees at the end of every prayer, no matter whether kneeling, sitting, or standing. He thought that dusting his knees was part of the ritual of prayer. There are words in every language that are so culturally bound that a translation is sometimes nearly impossible. Good examples in English are expressions such as slumber party, bridal shower, or trick or treating. When dealing with words that are so culturally bound, the translator has to decide what the best solution is, depending on the role of the expression in the original text. If the expression is incidental, perhaps it can be adapted or even deleted. If the expression is crucial to the story, it will probably have to be explained. Now, all these things the Church Translation Department knows very well. As a matter of fact, the Church translators have been using, at least since the 70s, a number of advanced translation techniques. In 1974, for instance, Justice Ernst, who was the manager of special projects at the Translation Services Department, wrote about several of the problems that the Church translators had to tackle.
Ernst mentions, for example, the problem that they face with the film Five Principles of Supervision. At a certain point in the film, the main character reproaches himself for cowardice. He looks in the mirror and sees reflected a large chicken. The problem, of course, is that in most languages around the world, the word chicken does not stand for coward. A good example of the kind of problems raised by LDS culture has to do with the Mormon focus on sports. First, because the Mormon Church has made of basketball one of its most ubiquitous cultural exports. Whether in Paraguay, Great Britain, or the Philippines, the most salient feature of the Mormon chapel is not the baptismal font, but the basketball court. Some church leaders seem to believe that one may lead to the other. An important use of sports in Mormon discourse has to do with baseball-inspired stories of courage and triumph that we typically hear in priesthood sessions of General Conference. The problem, of course, is that, with the exception of Caribbean and Mexico, baseball is completely alien to the Hispanic world. You can probably translate words such as baseball and bat, but what do you do when a general authority talks about home runs, strikes, or the Baseball Hall of Fame? Now, does it bother me that baseball stories don't translate well into Spanish? Not really. Am I worried that we are building basketball courts in Paraguay or in the Philippines or in Timbuktu? Not at all. What worries me is that from missionary suits to missionary discussions, from architectural trends to financial practices, from the correlated curriculum to the hierarchical organization, a more general pattern of Mormon culture begins to emerge. It is a model of corporate culture. Just like a language, this cultural model sends a strong message to the international church and to the world. It talks about who we are and how we operate. It exposes the core of our value system. Like a secret handshake, or perhaps not that secret, it instantly gives a certain status, aligning friends and foes across the world. Now, when I see the Mormon model of corporate culture, I really get scared. Contrary to what they say, corporations are not in the business of helping people or making them happy. If they help people or make them happy, that's merely incidental. Corporations are in the business of helping themselves to become bigger, to take over other corporations, and to expand all over the world. Just like in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, a stone is cut out without hands, consumes every image and every kingdom, and fills the whole earth. In the last 50 years, we have seen the LDS Church. This is the conclusion, so we're close to the end. In the last 50 years, we have seen the LDS Church gradually move toward the concept of being an international church and a worldwide religion. And yet the church refuses to adapt to different cultural paradigms. Moreover, it has adopted a pervasive model of corporate culture. This is not merely external, a temporal model. It is also spiritual in the sense that it sanctions acceptable patterns of speech, behavior, and spirituality. President Hinckley seems to be proud that on any given Sunday, you'll find even the same Sunday school lesson being taught around the world. But I'm not proud. I'm worried. I'm worried about the high place that the model of corporate culture occupies in our religion. I am worried that eventually this model may become our only form of religion. For many of us who were born in the third world, the problem is not simply that the church leaders have adopted for themselves this model of corporate culture. The problem is that they feel constrained to show and promote it, that this model, wherever they go. All the general authorities living in Latin America claim that they want local people to see beyond the posh buildings and the expensive cars, just to give an example. But none of them is willing to stop designing posh buildings and driving expensive cars. If you believe that God gave us all this money and all this technology to spread the gospel, I guess it follows that God is the ultimate CEO. Somehow, posh buildings and expensive cars must be an essential part of the sacred language. This model of corporate culture must be at the heart of our religion. In July 1974, Elder Dean L. Larson declared, "There is no room in today's far-flung church membership for narrow local interests and provincialism. The segmenting biases that worked such destructive influences in the early church of Paul's day cannot be allowed to take root in this dispensation. I think this is an inspired statement, but why are we then forcing the whole church to submit to the corporate cultural model that emanates from Salt Lake City? Perhaps the church leaders are attempting with the corporate model the same thing that they attempted in the 70s with computers. But as our society reacts with anger sometimes against the model of corporate culture, the church will find itself increasingly at odds with the people they are trying to reach. It seems to me that the ultimate problem that the LDS church must face is neither linguistic nor cultural, not even anthropological. It's simply a question of arrogance. The crucial decision that the church faces is not how to translate and adapt its literature, but whether the church will translate and adapt itself. The way I see it, this adaptation would involve a complete transformation, not simply becoming more eager to embrace local custom, but effectively decentralizing the organization, democratizing the institution, and disbanding the machinery of correlation. The myth of the perfect language and the model of corporate culture are both based upon the idea that through a perfect code, you can transcend human limitations. Adamic represents a perfect form of verbal communication. Corporate culture guarantees a perfect model for organizational behavior. In the story of Babel, the people attempted to reach unto heaven. God cursed them by confounding their language. For those of us who believe that Mormonism has adopted a perfect cultural model, God might be exacting an even greater curse to make us believe that we have finished the mythical tower, that we are indeed at the top of the world, and that everyone should follow and understand the model example. Because not only have we in our religion the perfect message, we also have in our culture the perfect language. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I won't say anything more than just remember that if you are struck by any insights in this paper, it's just they're not mine. They're David Knowlton's. He's in Peru. I would expect that you would feel welcome to pass any comments on to him or try to get them to him somehow. So I'll just read. I'm delighted to comment on Hugo's paper. I feel it raises a number of critical issues that need discussing within the broader Latter-day Saint community. I wish I could be there with you today to do more than simply to leave this written comment. It would be delightful to participate in a lively discussion that no doubt will arise among you. But I am in Cusco, Peru, teaching a graduate class on the anthropology of Andean religion, so I can only send you my comments in written form for Scott to read. Hugo's paper is important for a number of reasons. First, it reinitiates a debate from the 70s, which frankly should not have finished, around the nature of culture in relationship with the Mormon term gospel. Gospel is in quotes. The debate primarily posed the question of what a culture-free gospel would look like. It argued that something like that must exist and be attainable. Actually, this was more asserted than sustained through careful argument. Just as Hugo writes about the quest for the universal language, this quest for a universal culture or gospel is really quite naive, although very significant for our community. The BYU anthropologist John Sorensen intervened in the debate to insist on the radical relativism of the concept of culture. Just as we live in a babel of languages, so too do we humans depend on a babel of cultures. But that is the very thing that makes us human and which enables us to communicate with each other, problematic though that communication may be. Sorensen noted the critical challenge this notion makes toward any idea of the universal in language, culture, or even in religion. Mostly, Sorensen's remarks passed unheeded. Several things make them relevant today. Among them is the existence of the church in many languages and cultures. The very notion of God, the very notions of God, salvation, etc., are so culture-bound, i.e. drawn up in our history and culture, such that to us they seem to make sense and to exist as simple realities, that they are untranslatable. One wonders what the message of Mormonism really is in Aymara, Quechua, Quiche, Navajo, Tongan, Chinese, Japanese, etc. It is doubtful that many of our key concepts and realities that we reference with the term gospel have easily and successfully survived implantation in such diverse languages and their host cultures. In the 70s, the issue was exciting as the church moved into the world, and it spoke to an attempt to separate a gospel package from Wasatch Front culture that could be transplanted as part of a missionary effort. It was the first it was a first concern about the notion of culture in its challenge to the universality of any gospel. But now, in the new century, we have decades of additional experience, and it is time to reframe and reformulate the question based on that experience. People from outside the Wasatch Front, home of Mormonism, are now speaking back. Hugo's paper would lose its guts and drive were it not that he grew up as a Latter-day Saint in Argentina, raised in a Spanish Mormonism that is similar, but not identical, to other Spanish Mormonisms and to the dominant Wasatch Front Anglo-Mormonism. We have someone born in the church, from Zion abroad, not nurtured in a different language, trained as a linguist, telling us in our tongue that our desires were naive and that we are characterized by ignorance in our insistence on the priority of our conceptions. Wow. This is the second reason why Hugo's paper is important. It is inviting us to a dialogue with culture and the priority of our simple attachment to the value of our own culture on the table as open questions. This will be a difficult conversation, but it is a very important one. In other words, we now need to return to the debate about the gospel and culture, but this time not in the abstract. Instead, we need to engage our fellow members of the community in a meditation that does not presume the validity of our position, but that allows us to see ourselves and our pretension vis-a-vis the Lord as also culture-bound and hence contingent. Potentially, it brings a lot of humility and faith into the debate. As we begin now that path to asking what is universal, if anything, about the gospel, now without quotes, we need to make some distinctions, I think. First, the question of whether there is anything universal or not is in some ways a trap. It is intellectually stimulating and vitally important, but it is too easy for the question to remain here. Really, the question needs to be, given human diversity, is there anything really communicable to all nations, kindreds, tongues, and peoples? And we should ask whether it matters if there is nothing. If there is a God, can he not work within human diversity? But then, what does that imply for the restoration? What was important in that act, and what was not, in the face of diversity and the problems for us and God of communicating within it? A separate question is that of the new wine in old wineskins. I'm writing from Cusco, the old capital of the Inca Empire, where for 500 years Catholicism has attempted to make this a Catholic country. In many ways, they have succeeded, but indigenous Inca-like religion still lives in the hearts and souls of the people. It is almost impossible to separate the one from the other in their practices and beliefs. Similarly, where y'all are, Christianity is a strange amalgam of Germanic paganism and Middle Eastern and Mediterranean Christianity, in a way that does not make much sense unless its pagan roots and continuities are taken into account. There can be no culture-free religion. Although President Hinckley's remark to the LA Times journalist Teresa Watanabe is cute and good public relations, it is also naive. It confuses form and substance. Sure, the same Sunday school lesson can be taught, but does that mean that the substance behind that lesson is the same in different contexts? The wineskin, the context matters, as Hugo so deftly notes. You can guarantee the same form, but you cannot guarantee the same substance, either among teenagers in Salt Lake or in Puno, Peru. A third question to be distinguished, then, is that of the historical and social developments of kinds of universalism. The very idea of universality has a history and moves on the back of potent political economic forces. It itself is in no way universal. The universalism and arrogance of Mormonism are part of this historical movement that in some ways is easily characterized in the concerns around globalization today. This movement allowed the church's origin, gave it form, and has allowed it to spread. It may be that there is still enough movement in that social legend to move the naive position that Hugo justifiably criticizes forward into the foreseeable future, But if so, what does that mean for our community and the inequalities within it? What does it mean for the notion of carrying the gospel to every nation, tongue, and people, if we first have to wait for their culture to be globalized, for them to make sense of our God and our plan of salvation? One final comment. Hugo notes the inequality of class created by the preference given to our version of English in the church. There is an empirical and ethnical concern here. First, how are Latter-day Saints stratified across the globe? How important is the role of English towards developing inequalities in Zion? The topic of cultural conflict and inequality in Mormonism is one that needs study, both historically and currently. We tend to think we are one and fail to see the imposed hegemony and inequality in that stance. Second, is it right for there to be this kind of socioeconomic differentiation within the church? With that, I will close. I want to thank Hugo for a thought-provoking and insightful paper. I also want to thank Scott for reading my all-too-turgid prose. And thank you all for coming and participating in what I think is a critical debate for the future of the church.
Thank you, Hugo. Thank you, Scott. And thank you, David, vicariously. We have basically a half hour for questions. We do not have a detachable mic, so what I'm going to ask you to do is, you know, state your question, and then have, I presume Hugo will be the respondent to, I guess, all the questions. Have Hugo repeat the question for us into the mic, please. I'm going to start, though. I'm going to exercise my prerogative as chair and get this thing started. Hugo, if I'm understanding you correctly, you are arguing that traditionally we have understood that translation works this way. There is some abstract meaning underneath the language itself, which you can just transplant from one language to the next. Right? I have a word which means this concept in English. I just look for the same word for the same concept in Spanish. You're arguing, and David's arguing, that that's naive. That in fact, you can't separate the words and the concepts. That when you, words are always implicated in culture, they're always implicated in history, so translation always means just approximating the meaning. And you're arguing the same thing with culture, that we think there is some kind of abstract gospel that transcends culture that we can simply transplant from one culture to the next, and you and David are arguing that that is naive, that in fact taking the church from the Wasatch Front to, say, Cusco is going to involve some kind of radical change. So I guess my first question would be, how do we deal with this? I mean, what would that mean? What would it mean to translate the church into another culture?
The question that is about translating as interpreting correctly. Okay, now I have two questions, and I'm trying to remember the first one. Oh, the first one is how we deal with this issue. Well, toward the end of the paper, I give some suggestions about things that would imply major changes that the church would have to do. Of course, this is not something that the church seems to be in the direct interest at this point of doing. I myself, growing up as a Mormon in Argentina, I don't think I had this realization that Catholicism and other churches that were also in Argentina were completely different in terms of their relationship to Rome or to other parts of the world. In the case of, but it is a case that the Catholic Church in Argentina is an Argentine organization with Argentine leaders that mostly make their own decisions. And Argentine culture and the kind of Catholicism that people practice in Argentina, it's not, they are not that far away. They are really interrelated somehow. In the case of the Mormon Church, we have this hierarchical model that we don't allow any kind of deviation from the cultural model in terms of many things, but my main focus here was the overall organization, this what I call the corporate culture. What I say at the end of the paper tends to suggest that perhaps the church should try to adapt itself to stop worrying about correlation, for instance, and things like that. Many of you know this, for instance, the missionary program, the fact that all our missionaries go dressed the same, and how that is shocking sometimes to different people. And the church is proud of this uniformation or this same standard. We promote this standard with our converts. We are proud to say that such and such is getting baptized and decided to, you know, shave his long hair and, you know, come to church with a white shirt and ties. We really promote this model. I think that ultimately the church will have to decide whether they feel that this model continues to be the way they want to go or if they want to change. Many other churches changed. Well, no, I didn't say that. But you mean translating is literature? Translating in the sense of... Oh. Well, one example, yeah, that's a good question. In the case of materials, for instance, what has happened with correlation is that now all the materials are produced here and then they are translated and sent throughout the world. It seems to me that many other churches have a different model. They produce locally in the different countries, they produce their own literature. There's a very interesting case in Argentina in relation to Liaona, which is the equivalent to Ensign, is the magazine, the international magazine. Till the 50s, through the early 50s, the magazine was not published or was not produced in Salt Lake City. It was produced in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. It was called El Mensajero de Ceret. It was a local magazine. And it seems to me that it was a lot more successful than when the magazine started to come from Rosa Lake, because it was a magazine produced by the members there, the articles were made by the members there, and the stories had to do with the members there. So this is an example of how literature could be produced locally. No, that's not my point. The point of the paper is to present translation as a metaphor for something else, or the impossibility of translation, or the dangers of believing in a universal language as a metaphor for something else, and believing in a universally understood and, you know, change from culture to culture. Well, I think that final statement by David had to do with social inequality, the dangers of social inequality, and how a Zion society, although David doesn't use the word that, perhaps we should think of a less inequal socially and economical society. But yeah, I don't think we can overcome diversity. I will take other questions. I don't know if they are going to do with the same. Yeah, here.
Pride ourselves in Mormon culture as being multilingual very often, because we have all these returned missionaries from all over the place. And we find this in the army, for example, that they use Mormon translators a lot. And it's going to be a great advantage for the Olympics, because we have all these people who know lots of languages and so forth. In the hierarchy, do we have very many people who know other languages? The last general assembly that I can remember giving a talk in a language other than English, on the go, other than the few who were born, or speaking, I mean native English speakers who can speak another language, with Joseph L. Anderson, who is gone many years now, but he in his advanced years, he still spoke fairly good German. I'm trying to think of a president of the church who we've ever had who was fluent in another language.
I don't know if Wojciechowski speaks Spanish. Faust speaks Portuguese. Scott speaks good Spanish because he served many years there. And there's Yeah, when they go there all the time, they do it. You know, some very well, some not that well, but to the extent that they can, they try to do it. There was an example of something interesting in a general conference, I think it was about 10 years ago. And now I'm trying to remember, I don't remember the details, but it was a general authority, English speaking, who had previously recorded his speech in Spanish because he was fluent in Spanish. So instead of using the interpreter or the translator's voice during that particular segment, the feed was his own previously recorded message. I thought that was interesting, an attempt to reach the people in their own language with his own voice. Yes, over there. I agree with you. And I myself as a missionary have been using mythological stories that they had, the Guarani people had about Nyandejara, the Guarani version of Jesus Christ, walking among them and then, you know, singing a song that is theirs and then talking about, you know, Jesus appearing to the Nephites in the Book of Mormon. I believe that's true. However, I also believe that in the more general anthropological sense, all religions, in the sense that they are trying to do missionary work and advance around the world, they can be accused of doing that. And an extreme political correctness would perhaps imply that we should never try to preach the gospel to anyone because we have such a respect for their original religion and beliefs. Well, yes. Yes, that too. Yes, I don't think I even addressed your question. I don't know, were you, I don't know if you were thinking about Joseph Smith. I know that Joseph Smith, I said that from Joseph Smith we inherited two versions of what translation is. And one is somewhat sophisticated because it seems to me that to a certain extent he believed that translating was interpreting. And that several different interpretations can be done on the same passage, meaning that several types of translation can be done, right? So, yes, I think that we inherited both theories of what, of both views of what translation is. Yes, here? I certainly believe that maybe the time will come when they honestly will believe, will realize that they are, the church is not growing anymore because they are offending too many people, you know, if you want to put it that way. And the other factor that we have, particularly in the Mormon Church, is that we are sending very young people. I have read diaries and journals from 19-year-old boys who go to our and you see these outrageous, you know, comments that they would make. And they were very young. They are still very young. So to a certain extent, I wonder to what extent that can also be an element in offending, not being very aware of cultural differences that are not necessarily the fact that they are bad or
your
paganistic.
The missionaries, 1880 to 1940, were about the same.
Uh-huh.
Culturally naive, didn't know much about where they were going, thought that their culture was the right way, and that they had to teach these poor, unenlightened people the right way.
Yeah.
They've softened on that an awful lot now.
In Argentina, the Protestant model changed. And I don't know exactly the days, but now you have the Methodist Church, is the Argentine Methodist Church, led by local people. The Baptist Church is the Argentine Baptist Church. The Catholic Church is the local church. I think that is part of that attempt.
And what is the Mormon Church? The Mormon Church in Argentina is the American Mormon Church?
Well, hierarchically, the hierarchical relation is that here is the headquarters, and you send an area presidency there. They are, for one thing, usually they are American people, Utah people, most of them. But the other thing is that the most important factor is not the fact that they are Americans, but that there's a chain of command, right? And when the prophet says something, you know, they do it, we do it. So I realize that the implications of suggesting that that shouldn't be done, I mean, the implications would be to completely change the church, right? And to make it perhaps closer to the Anglican Communion, to give one example, but I don't know. I think that there's issues of cultural arrogance that are rooted in this situation. Yes, I don't know where I'm over there. You bring a very good point. I know that Mormons, and particularly certain, I can think, for instance, of President Spencer W. Kimball, his famous talk about the absolute truth, saying that the Mormon Church has the absolute truth. Now, if you believe that, if you believe that the gospel is the absolute truth, then it's more likely that perhaps you will believe that it is a universal language. Perhaps not the words themselves, but somehow it is a universal language. Perhaps it's related to the Holy Ghost, how it communicates from soul to soul. I don't know, depending on how you see the issue. But then again, from the strictly linguistic point of view, the Platonic theory of a perfect correspondence between concepts and words, we don't believe that, or linguists in general don't believe that anymore. We believe that the things are a lot more complicated than that. I personally, when I was in Berkeley, I took classes with Dr. Lakoff, who talks about this and how we organize reality in different ways. One simple example that he would give us is, well, let's say that you are categorizing the universe and you run into the word piano. Would you put it with furniture or would you put it with musical instruments, right? Reality is a lot more complex than categorizing the whole universe and all the words of the universe. So I see the tension there between a postmodern, if you wish, theory about meaning and words and the belief in an absolute truth of the gospel. Thank you.
this guy did.
Sorry, yes. Okay, good.
For example, I transitioned to Japan, and one way of attracting converts was to teach English. And I know that that will also have done a lot of things.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
I mean, we're attempting to sort of Americanize, but with a lot that transversion to the world, which both is, you know, is good, I guess, in some ways, and then bad in others.
Good, yeah, good comment. Yes, Nadine. Yeah, so far we see it as a strength, definitely.
But they're not retaining members.
Well,
yeah, at some point,
in Latin America, the church is growing a lot. The church is very, very happy with
regenerate.
So, well, I'm not sure. Middle East.
Where tattooing or body altering in some way is common and looked upon as a good thing and as a societal norm.
Yes.
And while that may be thought as naive and unpresent part, it really is what he believes, and in fact what our church members there should do is not tattoo, even though it might mean culturally there, you know, a status symbol or something. I mean, you know, the whole idea of the church is to standardize the world along the lines of what that trend. I mean, and I think they're proud of it.
Yeah, we are proud. We are proud of that. The gentleman with the blue, dark blue shirt. Purple, sorry.
I wanted to follow up on Eugene and this woman over here's comments about Protestant missionaries. There is a big difference between Mormon missionaries and Protestant missionaries historically. That is, Protestant missionaries typically go to a place and live there for decades of their life. And so they have the time to mature and to adapt to that local culture. Mormon missionaries stay for a very short period of time.
And right, you
typically are naive.
Anyway. And so they're just putting in their time, and who's really driving this but the corporate machine?
Yes.
The other thing that is an extension of this is that the Protestant missionaries that actually have been the most successful in Latin America have not been those ones coming from the United States, but the ones that that some of them trained them, that they were local people who have then taken and built up local branches of Protestantism that do not have a hierarchy. Things that along the, in a sense, models like the Assemblies of God, which are largely locally derived, that's the Protestantism that's growing far more rapidly in Latin America than Mormonism. And Mormonism has got this hierarchical structure that impedes and slows our growth, that when contrasted with evangelical Protestants, they're having tremendous success, but they're not reproducing the exact same belief or something similar to even the same basic concepts. They change dramatically from one to the other.
Thank you. Good comment. Yes.
Hugo, to go back to what you were saying about Joseph Smith and the possibilities of different understandings of what translation means,
uh-huh.
and recognizing that you're using translation as a metaphor here, I think it's important that we keep in mind that the whole Mormon system of belief is based on a translation.
Yes.
A very specific translation from one kind of document to another kind of document, from one language to another language. And I dare say that the common understanding among Mormons of that process, of what happened there, is a pretty literalistic one, that there was a definite meaning on those plates that could be discerned or divined or inspired or revealed or however you want to describe it, and rendered accurately on paper in the English language. Now, if you read D&C 9, I think you might get a different interpretation, but that's not the one we commonly use. In D&C 9, it talks about how you have to study it out, and it might be a little complicated.
Yeah. Well, even Joseph Smith says this is the most correct translation, meaning that there might be some mistakes, but it's my mistake. The original Reformed Egyptian, or whatever you want to call it, is perfect. Maybe that is a good metaphor for that perfect truth.
I think that's the way we tend to, I think we tend to look at all kinds of translation issues that way.
Okay.
Brought to us through your assistance. So now we make these translations in other languages from English. It's not only secondhand, but it's higher in some guy's opinion.
Yeah, although they can, yeah.
It was going to be the modern day Urim and Thummim.
Yes, that's true. However, just making an addition to your comment, which is true, usually, and I've read several stories of translating, particularly the Book of Mormon into Spanish, most of the anecdotal evidence that comes in church publications, that usually talks about how these translators felt the Spirit to a certain extent, felt the help of some spiritual force to their work. There was a comment here by the lady with
I was just thinking that, and I really like her ideas and stuff, but like, I was like, there are people who like, were believing in Christ, but
Yeah, I don't know if I would use it. I have a minute. I don't think I would use the word conservative. Perhaps the example of the Assemblies of God, I don't know how conservative they are. Perhaps they are an example of a conservative church that has really lost some kind of central place from which everything goes, right? And and I understand how radically different it would be from the kind of Mormon church we have today. I don't know if there's time for more questions. Thank you very much. Sorry for the questions that I couldn't answer.
Thank you again for coming.